Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back once again on the program David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. He starts by making a few comments about what's going on with the economy, and he may have something specific to say that's investment related. And then if people have questions about that, whatever he's got to say here to start things out, or anything else that has to do with investing strategies, money management, you're welcome to call and, you know, ask your questions, and I know Dave will do his best to help you out. So with that, we say welcome back and glad to have you here once again.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. In my introductory remarks, I would first like to review some of the new 2009 rules, especially with respect to retirement plans such as 401k plans, Roth IRA programs, etc. Last month, as you'll recall on the program, we must have had 7 or 8 questions with respect to Roth IRAs and different traditional IRAs. So I thought perhaps we'd just take a few minutes to do that, as well as, of course, look at our couch potato portfolio and its negative results through yesterday's close on the U.S. and world stock markets. Now, clearly, the most impactful change for 2009 is the fact that older Americans who are required to take minimum distributions from their retirement programs are granted, well, let's call it a reprieve. That is to say that seniors do not have to take that dreaded required minimum distribution for calendar year 2009. Now, there is an exception to this problem. This exception applies to profit-sharing plans, 401k plans, 403bs, 457s, and traditional IRA plans. So there are a number of people, David, for example, who have substantial assets in one of these plans. They're over 70.5 years of age. They may be in a situation where they actually don't need the money. Their assets probably have gone down as a result of the abysmal performance of the U.S. and world stock markets in 2008, and they say, look, I'd really not like to have to take my minimum distribution. Well, in 2009, you don't have to. So that is a big advantage for people who really don't want to have to take a minimum distribution. Now, like everything else, there's a wrinkle in the rule. If you turned 70.5 years of age in the year 2008, the rule says you really don't have to take a minimum distribution until the April 1 following the year in which you reach 70.5. So there is a possibility that, gee, I reached 70.5 in 2008. I really don't want to take that minimum distribution in 2008, but I have to take it prior to April 1 in 2009. That 2008 distribution, you're still required to take. If you haven't taken it, you have to take it. But now, if I'm in 2009, I'm all caught up to date, I've taken my past minimum distributions, now in 2009, you don't have to take a 2009 distribution. Also, there are special rules with respect to charitable contributions for 2009. This is really a continuation of an old rule. If you are 70.5, you can actually, instead of taking a minimum distribution, having a check sent to you, you can tell your plan sponsor, look, I want to make some charitable contributions. Instead of sending me a check payable to me, make a check for my minimum distribution payable to the ABC charity. You can send the check to me and I will deliver the check, but don't make it payable to me. Make it payable to that ABC charity. So if you take IRA funds, and this really applies up to $100,000, again, you must be 70.5 years of age to take advantage of this rule, but you can actually make charitable contributions directly from your IRA funds. Now, when you do that, the monies that you used out of your IRA, they will not be subject to federal income tax. You don't get an additional deduction, a charitable deduction, when you itemize, but nevertheless, you essentially are getting a break because these funds are not subject to income tax. So we really have two very important rules. We have this charitable rule as well as, gee, in 2009, if I don't need a minimum distribution, I don't have to take it. And not only does the minimum distribution rule apply to IRAs, it also applies to these other defined contribution plans like 403Bs, like 401k plans, etc. Now, there's no time like the present to continue to save, especially younger people, for retirement. And that means funding an IRA program, and specifically funding, in my view, a Roth IRA program. Now, the 2009 contribution limit is $5,000 to fund a Roth IRA, so long as you or your spouse have at least $5,000 of income. So, I go to work, I make $50,000, maybe I participate in a 401k plan, maybe I don't have any kind of defined contribution pension plans at work. Nevertheless, I can fund for my own retirement, I can take money and establish a Roth IRA program, and I can take up to $5,000 of earned income and place it with a Roth IRA plan sponsor. Dividend income doesn't count. Interest income doesn't count. Rental income doesn't count. This is the kind of income through the sweat of our brow. We're either employed by someone else or we are self-employed. Now, interestingly enough, maybe you're in a circumstance where you make too much money, so you're not eligible to contribute to a Roth IRA. If you are a single person and you are earning $105,000 or less, then you are fully eligible to fund a Roth IRA up to $5,000. If you are married, filing joint returns, and your earnings are $166,000 or less, you are fully eligible to fund Roth IRA programs. And then there are some phase-out rules, which essentially mean that you can fund less depending on the size of your income. In additionally, if you are an old person, which really means for these particular rules, 50 years or older. So, David, I guess that includes me, but I know you're still a youngster. So David's saying no, it certainly doesn't include him. You can actually contribute an additional $1,000 as a catch-up provision to your particular Roth IRA program. Now, with respect to 401ks, 403b plans, interestingly enough, the deferral limits have increased. These are limits where you take money out of your paycheck and you put it into these kinds of programs. The 2009 limit for 401k plans from your paycheck, 403b plans, is actually $16,500. What a wonderful problem if you could put $16,500 of your own pay into one of these retirement programs. And again, there is a catch-up provision for people over 50 years of age. That's $5,000. So imagine putting $21,500 into the plan. Obviously, with a 401k or a 403b, you are getting an upfront tax deduction. And interestingly enough, many, many employers have now introduced what are called Roth 401k plans or Roth 403b plans, where you essentially pay the tax on your earnings and then you take after-tax money and you fund a Roth 403b or a Roth 401k. And all of those earnings, the real beauty of that is that all of the earnings into the future grow tax-free. And of course, as we know, with a Roth IRA, if we follow the rules, then all of those earnings as well grow tax-free. And many people ask me, should I be in a Roth IRA, a traditional IRA, or should I be in a traditional 401k or a Roth 401k? And you know, the more I see, the more I'm convinced that you are better off paying the tax today and utilizing a Roth program, whether it's a Roth 401k or a Roth IRA. Because if you believe, as I do, that ultimately income tax rates are going to be higher, which may ultimately throw you into a higher tax bracket, it certainly would be very, very nice to have tax-free income coming in at retirement. And as long as we have these tremendous budget deficits and as long as we are holding interest rates artificially low, there is a whole lot of pent-up inflation somewhere down the road. It may not be today, tomorrow, next week, or even next year, but somewhere down the road, there is a lot of pent-up inflation, a lot of pent-up deficit, and that strikes me that we are going to lead into higher income tax rates eventually. Next, I want to remind anyone with a residential mortgage to recheck their interest rate on their residential mortgage. Again, residential mortgage rates are trending back to their historic lows. And in some parts of the country, the 30-year fixed interest rate on a mortgage has actually broken 5%. The 15-year fully amortized rate is in the high fours, maybe 4.8, 4.9. So if you are in a variable, it may be very intelligent now to roll that variable and refinance into a fixed rate mortgage. They are really getting very close to their historic lows, and they can't go a whole lot lower based on current formulas. So take a careful look at that, especially if you're in what is called an ARM, an adjustable rate mortgage. Strongly consider a fixed rate now. All right. Every month, of course, we also review our couch potato portfolio, and we compare it to our benchmark S&P 500. Obviously, it's no surprise to anyone that that portfolio last year finished the year down about 38%, not very much different than the S&P 500. Essentially, diversification for the first time in many, many years didn't help. Now, the actual portfolio and its asset allocation can be accessed on the WILL website. And David, I know to access it, there's a special website address.
That's right. It is on our old website, and that is WILL.UIUC.edu. And there's a little confusion here because we have a new one and an old one. If you want the links, including the couch potato, go to the old one, WILL.UIUC.edu.
Right. Click on Focus 580, click on Links, click on Couch Potato Portfolio, and you'll find it. And it is already updated through yesterday's close. Suffice it to say that the portfolio consists of a variety of stock indexes, encompassing both large and small stocks, value and growth stocks, as well as international and emerging market stocks. Now, through last night's close, well, the portfolio year-to-date, no big surprise, is negative. It's down approximately 7.9%. The S&P 500 is down about 6.5% through last night's close. So our portfolio is trailing the S&P 500, which tells you that when we look at all of the various stock indexes, that to the extent there is any strength, it's in bigger companies. It's in the Dow. It's in the S&P. And almost every other index at the moment is trailing the S&P. And particularly troubling is the REIT index, the real estate investment index. It was down dramatically last year in excess of the S&P, and already this year it is down some 14% year to date in the first few days of trading. So it's no surprise January has been abysmal. In fact, through the first 15 trading days, it's been about the worst January in the history of U.S. stock markets. So we'll have to stay tuned to that. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about IRAs. We've talked a little bit about mortgages and interest rates. We've talked a little bit about the S&P 500 and the couch potato portfolio, the stock market. So, David, I'd be delighted to answer questions on issues I've raised or certainly anything from our listening audience.
All right. Well, we have several people ready to go here. The number, if you'd like to call in and talk with Dave, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. He's here once a month, always on a Friday. We talk about personal finance. First caller is in St. Joe, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Dr. Sinnoh, I really appreciate your comments at the beginning of the show. I know there was a listener that criticized the length of them, et cetera, but they are so helpful, and I think the majority of people that are listening will say, yes, keep on keeping on.
Well, thank you.
Good. I got a couple questions. First is, do you know right offhand the percent of the asset allocation in your couch potato portfolio for the international funds?
Yes, I can tell you that. The total international index is 26.5% of all of the stock equities, and the emerging markets index is 5%. So essentially, I'm at 31.5 international, and that leaves, what, about 68.5 U.S.
Ah, great, great. Okay. The other thing is that I recently read an article on estate planning.
Yes.
And one point was the ability to give away assets at the rate of $13,000 per person per year. When was that account amount increased?
Well, that is the new amount for 2009.
Oh, okay.
All right. That is what is called the annual gift exclusion.
Okay.
So if you are in a particularly charitable, jolly frame of mind, what I would suggest is that you just pull out your checkbook and start writing checks of $13,000 to David Sinow. That's S-I-N-O-W, Renee and Megan Sinow. So you have it. Now, interestingly enough, you've raised a great point. For married couples, they could essentially gift $26,000 to as many people as they want. This has nothing to do with charity. This is just simply the annual gift exclusion.
Right.
And lots of folks who are fortunately have substantial assets, they gift to children and grandchildren each year to lessen the size of their gross estate because their gross estate ultimately is going to be subject to estate tax.
Great. Yeah.
So the 2009 rule is 13K. Thank you so much for pointing that out.
Super. Another question. In that same article, they were talking about a zero-tax estate plan. Is it really possible to have something like that?
Well, a zero-tax estate plan, at least currently, is based upon the total amount of gross assets that you have in an estate subject to estate tax. Now, there are ways to have a zero-tax estate plan. For example, anyone who dies and leaves a surviving spouse and everything is left to the surviving spouse, at first death, there is no tax. All right? That is called the marital exclusion.
Right.
In addition, at least for 2009, that if you had a substantial estate, and let's say you had $1 million or $2 million estate, and you gave it to your children, there is something called the unified credit. And in 2009, I've got to look it up, but I believe you can leave an estate of as much as $3 million not subject to any estate tax. But it's very, very difficult unless you give all of your money away to charity, which you could certainly do, or alternatively, leave it to a surviving spouse. That is certainly a possibility. Otherwise, basically, you're going to owe estate tax unless your estate is $3.5 million or less in the year 2009. Now, in 2010, under the estate tax rules, apparently Congress did away with estate tax. So I tell my students, if they have a 100-year-old grandparent who is on their last lap and very, very wealthy, to please hold on until 2010. Then it's okay to pass away. And interestingly enough, in 2011, the estate rules sort of go back to the olden days where the exemption equivalent amount is only $1 million and every dollar after that is taxed at 55%. So you can bet that one of the things that Congress is going to be doing, if not this year, but pretty quickly, is revising these estate tax rules.
Well, I hope so.
I hope so too. But as far as having a zero tax estate, unless you give it away to charity, leave it to your spouse, or have an estate in 2009 less than $3.5 million, don't think there is anything that you can really do beyond that, other than you can obviously provide some fancy estate tax planning methodology through your attorney that can further ameliorate the impact, but you're still going to owe tax on the estate.
Yeah, but even if you leave it with the surviving spouse, then at the death of the surviving spouse, that's what I'm concerned about.
Absolutely. So people use what are called bypass trusts. They sometimes use second-to-die life insurance policy through irrevocable insurance trusts. But all of those things cost a lot of money, and you need to have a competent estate planner to properly advise you.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thanks a lot.
All right.
My pleasure.
Thanks, caller. And they are in Sycamore, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a tax question that's been gnawing at me for some time because last year I had a very large tax liability because of some stock sales.
Okay.
And this year, of course, my income is back down to the normal levels, and I, being retired, have to pay quarterly. So I have to estimate my tax.
Yes.
So I've tried to estimate very accurately based on the best rules of the tax code that I have available to me through the year, making these quarterly payments. Now,
yes.
Here in January, I get my new tax forms, and I find, hey, the rules have changed. I owe a lot more than I thought I did. So, okay, I can try to make that up by making a larger fourth quarter payment here in January 15th. But what happens when the IRS looks at all this and says, hey, you know, according to the rules, this guy owed a lot more tax than he paid in the first three payments.
Well, actually, if you pay in based upon your 2007, I presume that's what you were doing. For your 2008 tax bill, your quarterlies, you were actually paying in on the basis of your 2007.
No, I didn't want to do that because 2007 was a very unusually large income.
Ah, 2007 liability. Was your large year.
Yeah.
And so 2008, you're making quarterly payments based upon what you believe you're going to owe in 2008.
That's right.
All right. Make 110% of what you think is going to be owed in 2008, and then you should be in good shape. So make your last quarterly payment, your fourth quarter, mm-hmm. and put enough in so you have 110% of what you believe your final tax bill will be. Then you're going to probably have to get a refund, and then you should be fine.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to get a refund because I'm not in the business of owing the government free money or loaning them free money. So
well, I thought we did that all the time. I thought that was our life.
So in any case, I didn't do that. I went to around 95% what I thought. And I think it's going to be okay, but what you're saying is if you want to be sure...
Absolutely.
You've got to do 110.
Well, if you do 110, you'll be in good shape, and then you won't have any issues with penalties. Now, are you working on your own tax return, or do you use a financial accountant?
No, I roll my own, do my
okay.
own thing.
Okay, so you do your own thing with TurboTax or Tax Cut or something.
Right.
Okay. Well, I would suggest that you rather be safe than sorry, because one of the things that can happen is that you can also subject yourself to an audit, and it just isn't worth it. One of the factors that goes into audits is whether or not you underestimate on your quarterly payments. So you're more likely to be audited because you're paying quarterly to begin with, and you're just going to up that if you have underestimated what you pay in.
Okay, though that's definitely something to keep in mind. What I always do is fill out the 2210 to make sure,
sure.
annualized amounts are correct. And so far, I've been very successful at that.
Okay, well, that's all I can advise you. You know, you have to play the cards the way you want to.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much.
All My right, pleasure.
Thank you. We're at midpoint here in this first hour of Focus 580 today. Once a month on a Friday, we talk about money management with David Zinno. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. So questions are welcome. I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a question about U.S. savings bonds. They were from payroll deductions of my husband, and he had them made out to himself or me. And I wonder, with your advice, if you could give it, please, what I should do with these. I have a great stack of 50s and 100s.
Well, is your husband still living?
No, he passed away about 10 years ago.
Oh, all right. Well, what I would do is I think you should take them to the bank
mm-hmm.
and find out whether or not they are still drawing interest.
Uh-huh.
And if so, at what interest rate?
Okay.
Many of these bonds are drawing higher interest today than placing the money in a money market account, et cetera. So I think your first step is they will be able to immediately have forms. You could probably do this yourself on a computer, but to be honest about it, it's so much easier just to go down to your bank where you keep the bonds, if you have a lockbox, or maybe you keep them at home,
right,
and have them value them for you and explain the various options that you have with the bonds. What you don't want to have is a circumstance where you have a bond that no longer is accruing interest.
Right.
And so those bonds, probably it would be best to cash those bonds in. Now, understand that you will have accrued interest on those bonds and you would have to pay tax,
yes,
on those bonds.
Right. All right. That's what I needed to know.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
We will go on. And the next caller is someone also in Champaign. This is line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for taking my call. It's a little bit complicated, and I'm trying to get it down to its bare bones.
Okay.
My husband and I are retired, and in retirement, we planned to build a vacation home, which we're in the midst of. The stock market didn't cooperate very well with us, but we were already in the midst of it. And we put money in a 457 account in money market funds, thinking we would use that money for this occasion. And now I'm trying to think through possibly borrowing from our Roth IRA, and therefore we would not have to pay taxes on that money because we already did. And I am curious what the privileges you have to pay back your Roth if you borrow from it, and wondering if you would have a recommendation if we should take money market funds that we would have to pay taxes on or do the borrowing from the Roth.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are you both retired?
Yes.
All right. And you have a Roth IRA?
Yes.
And are you both over 59 and a half?
Soon. Yes, I probably am. Yes.
Okay. So, number one, when you take money out of a Roth IRA after age 59 and a half, you really aren't borrowing it. You're simply taking a distribution out of your Roth IRA. And if you are 59 and a half and the Roth has been in existence for 5 years or more, basically the monies that will come out of that Roth will not be subject to tax. So if you
have... back in.
No, you can't put it back in.
Okay.
No, it is a distribution.
Okay.
So if you have a choice between taking money out of a Roth with no tax impact versus taking money out of a 457 at tax impact, my first reaction would be to take it out of the Roth. However, is the Roth in money market or is the Roth in stocks?
Some of each.
Okay. Here's what I would suggest. Because you probably have taken losses in those stocks in the Roth. Is that fair to say?
Well, not really. They were in cash reserves.
Oh, great.
Until just December.
Okay.
And did a little bit in an S&P 500.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. What I would probably do is if I were going to take money and I did not want to indebt myself with a mortgage, and usually I don't recommend that for people in retirement, because that becomes burdensome, is to consider taking money out of the Roth and let your money ride in the 457.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I'll continue thinking about it.
All right.
Do you know in the 457, is there a mandatory required distribution?
Not until 70 and a half.
But at 70 and a half,
right,
the same as the
same rules. Same as a 401k. 457,
right.
403.
So our only place where we don't have to take it out is the Roth. That was another variable that I was taking
right.
Into
the Roth,
account.
You never have to take it out.
Right.
You can
right.
leave it to your heirs by designating a beneficiary. Mm-hmm. The question is that if you take a substantial amount of money out of your 457, it may push you into a higher income tax bracket.
Right.
So you've got to look at that.
Try to stay under mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. earlier this morning when you said if you believe taxes are going to increase, which I do,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, maybe it's better to take the tax hit now and stay under income brackets that make sense.
Right. But if you take money out of the 457 and it doesn't increase your income tax bracket, mm-hmm. then that is certainly a strong possibility. If you don't see yourself, in other words, moving into lower tax brackets, and most people in retirement actually don't, mm-hmm. and you probably won't either, then you certainly could consider that as well, especially if it's in cash, because you haven't been hemorrhaged. You haven't taken
right.
a financial hit.
Your first thought was the Roth.
Well, I was thinking of the Roth, if it's going to, especially if you take money out of the 457, it's going to push you into a higher tax bracket.
Right, but it may be a way to do some of each of those.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. Now, here's something else I would suggest.
Okay.
If you take money out of the Roth and it happens to be on the stock side of the equation?
We wouldn't. It would just be the cash.
Okay, good. Because I was going to suggest then to take some of your 457 money and dollar cost average back into the stock market. That's another possibility.
Mm-hmm.
If you're sitting on a lot of cash over the next 18 to 24 months, is dollar cost average in at these very, very low prices?
If you believe in my lifetime the stock market will ever come back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure,
I do. I do.
You do.
I think you should too.
Okay.
I think you should too.
Okay.
Okay, does this help at all, this discussion?
Yes, it did.
All right,
thank
a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Very good. A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go on to another caller here. Belgium, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you, sir?
I'm just fine. I hope your monkey's well too.
Thank you.
I have always talked to you about the fact that we print a lot of money in the economy. It's really going to cause us problems. Today, I'd like to suggest to you there's another problem coming. And that's not only are a lot of people losing their jobs, a great deal number of people are not losing their jobs, but they're being told that they're going to be paid a substantial percentage less. Now, you say, what's going to cause problems there? Well, where's the taxes going to come from to pay all this stuff? From us. And if we're not being paid as much, where are we going to get the money to pay these bills we're going to have to do? And then the aspect that we have this TARP that is given essentially twice as much as our annual budget last year to the world, I guess. Where's all this money going?
You know, you're asking phenomenally difficult questions. I think something that you have hit on, and that is job loss in the economy. I think of all of the issues, that certainly is the most troubling as we continue to see this deterioration of jobs month after month after month with little abatement in sight. And you recognize something else that companies are doing. People are actually being paid less, not so much on an hourly basis, but through furloughs, and actually shutting down plants for a month at a time. And for the first time saying, gee, we're closing down and you're not going to be paid. So in a sense, you're taking a cut. And this is extremely troublesome. I don't have the answers to these issues. I don't have the answers to these issues. It took years of overspending to get into these situations, and it's going to take a substantial amount of time to figure this out. But you raise issues that really should be addressed to an economist, David, on the show, who probably is in a lot better position to talk about these things as opposed to myself with personal finance. I was down visiting earlier this week in Florida. I was visiting my mother, who was down there, and it was a bit warmer, I can report, down there, although yesterday it was fairly cold even in Florida. And Florida's job losses are just enormous. And interestingly enough, when we talk about home ownership in Florida, it's hard to believe that one out of approximately every nine homeowners in the state of Florida is either behind in their mortgage payments or has had at least one notice of foreclosure or is in foreclosure. Just extraordinary numbers.
If I might point out another employment thing, I'm around a lot of people who have different types of jobs, and one fellow came to me the other day and says he works for the railroad. He drives the trains. They're not giving him work. That means we're not shipping goods. That means there's no goods to be sold or bought. That's a scary thought.
Well, it is, and if you look at CRX, which is one of the huge shippers of rail, one of the major owners of rail, you look at FedEx, you look at UPS, obviously those are good indicators, they're leading indicators of what's going on in the manufacturing sector and the retail goods sector of the economy. It's a problem. So I share your pessimism. On the other hand, I am an optimist, and I don't want to scare people, because I believe that ultimately these issues are going to get solved. It's just going to be a very painful process.
Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
We're now moving into about our last 15 minutes. David Sino is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. He's here once a month on a Friday. We talk about money management kind of issues. And the idea behind the program is that we hope that it can be dispensing some practical, useful advice. At least if you have a specific question about your situation, you can call in here and talk about it with Dave and use that as part of your research, and of course, we always hope that you will think very carefully about whatever you do with your money before you do it. But this is one place you can get some information and add that to your total. So give us a call. We do have several people here who are waiting. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Help. I'm financially ignorant, but you have been so helpful. I took out with my friend a construction loan in 2006 from a small local bank. I put my house up for sale exactly when everything hit. The house is still up for sale, but it's rented. And I assumed that my construction loan would roll over into a mortgage. So I was happy to see the rates go down, only now I'm told by my banker that because I don't meet some 80% rule, this is over the phone, that our mortgage, we would have to come up with more money now to get a long-term mortgage. And then I have paid off a lot of my house and have very small payments. I'm going to have to put that into a loan, too, at a higher rate to this bank. And I'm just confused, I guess. Is it because of the financial situation, because my credit rating is very good?
Well, let me back up and make sure, yes, that I understand the facts. You currently have a rental property?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And on that rental property, is there a loan?
Yes.
And my understanding that it is a small loan?
Yes.
All right. So you have a substantial amount of equity in your rental property. Is that correct?
Yes.
And this rental property has been for sale?
Yes, I put it up for sale when everything hit, and it didn't sell, so I finally rented it.
Okay, and just so I understand this, in terms of loan to value, mm-hmm, would you say that your loan is 20% of the value, 30% of the value, 50% of the value?
My loan on my rental property?
Yep, yes.
I don't know. I guess I would say 20%.
Okay, so you have very, very substantial equity in that rental property.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Next, you are constructing a home currently?
It is constructed and we moved into it.
All right.
And we're still paying on a 6% construction loan.
Okay. Well, here is what I would do, because you can obviously obtain permanent financing at 5% 30 years, and it is true that is a conventional loan typically, mm-hmm, based upon a 20% down payment.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion would be to pull some money out of the rental property, all right, enough money so that you can finance your new home with a 20% down payment.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, you should then be eligible for superlative rates, assuming you have superlative credit, which apparently you have.
Well, that's when I discuss with the banker. He will give me a loan on my rental property.
Okay.
I mean, that would be another loan, and I guess I was confused by that.
Well, in order to obtain the best rate, uh-huh, on your new home,
mm-hmm,
you really want to put 20% down. However, mm-hmm, there are a number of programs that are available where you can put 10% down,
mm-hmm,
as little as 5% down, and the interest rate is not dramatically higher. So I'm not certain that you are working with someone who knows all of the rules.
Okay.
So one of my suggestions would be you don't have to necessarily be wedded to the bank that has provided you the construction loan,
mm-hmm,
that there are other mortgage lenders that you might consider talking to and going over your situation, at least two or three, so that you can review what is in your best interest and what the best rate program would be. If you like, you could call me off the air. I hesitate to give you the name of someone on the air, but you could call me off the air and leave your name and a phone number. My office phone number is 265-4083, and I would be happy to refer you to someone that I do business with personally that is of very high integrity and certainly knows all the rules, ins and outs, to help you through this process.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
Right, my pleasure.
Thank you. We'll go on here, and the next person we'll talk to is in Decatur, and that's line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have a quick question to clarify a point. Not that I'm anywhere close, but I was curious about the inheritance tax exclusion. You got a $3 million tax exemption for children. Is that additive? So if you've got two children, it's six?
No. Actually, the $3.5 million is the exemption equivalent in 2009 in total. So in other words, if someone passes away in 2009, leaves everything to their children, leaves everything to their friends, other than a spouse or a charity, and has a $3.5 million taxable estate, the tax on that estate is zero in 2009.
So that's total?
That's total.
Doesn't matter how many kids you've got.
Doesn't matter. Okay, no, it's a gross amount. Right. Doesn't matter how you divvy it up, so to speak.
Thanks a lot.
All right, very good. Next, line three, Champagne. Hello.
Yes. We bought our house a few years back, about 3 or 4 years ago. And we're considering refinancing. I know you mentioned this earlier, and I just want to double-check something. We're at about 5.62% paying that at this point, and we've been told we could bring it down to around 5%. But the issue of points came up, and I don't really understand points exactly. Is it basically 1% of the loan amount?
And you should not be paying any points. A point is a percent. So if you were being charged for the joy of procuring a loan, 1 point, that would be 1% of the amount that you're borrowing. Say you were borrowing $100,000, that would be $1,000. Do not pay a point.
That's right.
Do not do any business who is going to charge you a point on a residential mortgage. That is an absurdity in today's residential market.
Okay.
So what you really need to do is shop around and see what the closing costs will be, which typically are an appraisal. You can't get out of a new appraisal.
Right.
Title insurance. You have to have title insurance.
Right.
There's underwriting fees, documentation fees, but they could easily run say $1,000 to $1,500, all right?
Yeah.
And then you have to make a determination is what's the payback if we have a lower interest rate? Does it make sense?
Right.
Especially if we're going to stay in our home for a while and we're happy with our home, then it probably does make sense. Also, you want to do business with someone who will refinance you this time and charge you a fee, but if interest rates go lower, they will waive all of the fees to refinance you again. In other words, you don't pay any closing costs, and those closing costs are not folded in to your overall loan. So there are mortgage lenders and bank lenders who will refinance you a second and third time if interest rates precipitously drop again and you don't pay any additional costs.
Okay,
right?
That's important news.
That is important news, so you need to be a savvy consumer and ask these questions.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And we'll go on again. This is next another Champagne person, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
My wife and I have been debating about this. We don't know. We're not sure what to do. We had a college fund, a mutual fund for our kids, and we don't need to use it for 2 years, but I think just like anybody else in the stock market, it's really taken a beating. We don't need it for 2 years, and we're just trying to decide what should we do with it. Should we dump it? I mean, should we change it? Or
well, that's the $64 question. And what I've been telling people with college funds is hedge your bets. Better to be half right or half wrong than all wrong. So what I'm suggesting to people is, all right, if whatever that college fund is and you're very, very distressed about the stock market, and you're going to need access to some of that money in 24 months, and maybe the stock market hasn't improved one nickel in 24 months, or indeed it might even be slightly worse, then the answer is let's hedge our bets by taking 50% of the money and moving that into an interest-bearing money market fund inside our college funds as opposed to investing it in the stock market. And that way I'm going to at least be half right. If the stock market goes up, well, at least 50% of my money is going to get the benefit of the stock market. If the stock market stays neutral or moves down a little bit, at least I have the other 50% in fixed income, and I can utilize that toward the first year, if you will, of payments that I want to make in this college fund. Something else you want to keep in mind, and that is that if you don't need the money for 2 years, maybe take enough money out so you've covered the next 36 months. In other words, really take enough money out for that period of time in the third year when you're going to need money. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, you say within the fund itself, you mean from the same...
Yeah, the same family. In other words, what you've done is you're in a college funding program where you choose mutual funds. Is that correct?
Yes. You know, I have to admit, I don't know the detail of this. My wife has been handling this.
Oh, okay.
For all these years,
well, the bottom line is that what you want to do is when you make changes in your investments, you want to do it under the umbrella of the college fund. You simply don't want them to say, liquidate this and send me a check. Don't do that. You want to do it within the umbrella of the program that you are utilizing. So, in other words, if you sold 50% of your stock position and say transfer that into the money market position that you offer within the umbrella of this college program.
Is that so we don't pay tax?
Right. Right. So you don't have any tax issues or earnings issues.
I see.
Correct.
Okay.
And then the money will continue to grow tax-free so long as you use it for college education expenses. That's why.
Okay, you know what? I don't think that it's one of those specific college funds. I think it's just a mutual fund that we established a number of years back to pay for the kids' college.
Okay, so you are not under a actual college education program. You basically have said, gee, we ought to be putting money aside for our child's college education, which is very laudable indeed. All right, so now, and I presume that you are with some family of mutual funds?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, and that family probably has a money market alternative. Or one of the things that you could do, obviously, is when you sell some of those shares, either you're going to sell them at a gain or a loss. All right? And if there's a gain, you'll have a capital gain. If you have a loss, it's called a capital loss.
Okay.
And then you can take that money. It can be sent to you. Is the fund in your name or your wife's name?
Okay.
I presume it is.
Yes.
Then you can take that money, and I would put it in some kind of fixed income position, perhaps even something like a CD or a money market fund.
Okay.
And then it will be the first money that you would then access for this college education.
So would you set it up for like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
Well, you might. You might consider that, but interest rates are sort of at historic lows right now. So if I were going to buy a certificate of deposit, I probably would shop and look for a CD maybe in the one-year range and perhaps buy a CD with the highest one-year rate.
I see.
I would not go out and buy a 3 or 4 year CD. Don't do that.
Okay.
Hope that helps.
All right. Yes, that's been very helpful. Thank you
We
very much.
Will try and see if we can get one more caller in here, at least Clinton, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
My question is, my husband and myself are retired. He is 71. He does work part-time, and we wanted to open up a new Roth IRA. And we were wondering what vehicle to put this in. Right now, our portfolio is like 55 bonds, 45% stocks. And I didn't know if we should go into a balanced fund or what should we open.
Well, number one, I like your asset allocation. I like it a lot. So I think it's a very prudent asset allocation given these circumstances. I think you could invest either on the fixed income side of the portfolio or the stock market side of the portfolio. I'm based on your asset allocation, I'm neither partial to either. Either one would be fine.
Okay. Are you from in the Vanguard family? Because we are in that. The Wellesley shares, are you familiar with that?
I am. It's a great fund.
What would that – that would work?
That would work. And I think the way you would want to do that is Wellesley, does that require a $1,000 or $3,000 minimum?
Three.
What I would do is put the $3,000 in, and then if you're going to put more in for the year, is dollar cost average the rest of it over the 12-month period.
Oh, okay. All right. We wanted to go into Wellington, but that's a $10,000.
Right.
You can't go into that.
Right.
But this would be a good fund.
That would be fine. That would be fine. Just put the minimum in, and then each month dollar cost average until you get up to the maximum that you want to place in the fund.
Well, I didn't know, Ben's the other, if we should be a little more aggressive. All the other stocks are so low now. But
I think that's a good choice given your circumstance.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, we are at the point where I am very sorry to say that we must stop. We have a caller we cannot take. We also had somebody wondering, would you mind giving your phone number again?
My office phone number is 265-4083.
All right. Well, in that, we say our thanks to David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Once a month, it's always a Friday, he is here, and we do these shows on personal finance.
Well, thank you, David. Lots of great questions on a cold, blustery day.